In life, there are any number of unpalatable truths, bitter truths, truths that we would rather deny and push away. There's an old rabbinic proverb to the effect, Tzvol ha'emet, v'im tamar. Bear the truth, even if it is bitter. Over 2,000 years ago, an ancient teacher of Jerusalem, a man we now know as Kohelet, observed to his students, a fish caught in the net, a bird snared in the trap, so are the sons of men trapped in an evil day. Despite all our more romantic assumptions that there's always something we can do, some way out of a tough situation, there are occasions, times, evil days, when this is simply not the case. When we are snared as fish in the net, as birds in the trap. My greatest problem with the attempt on television recently to portray the final solution to the Jewish problem was that it shied away from the most bitter truths. It was written by those conditioned by American optimism, American power, our way of life, our assumptions. It was written in such a way that the age-old Western idea that I can make it work, I can solve the problem, that those who fail to solve the problem are somehow themselves part of the guilt. This was the equation, the line along which the TV program on the Holocaust was written. For me, that was not enough. Because the final solution to the Jewish problem was Germany's contribution to anti-Semitism. The Germans have a talent for efficiency, for engineering, and they simply found the effective way to resolve the Jewish problem, which has troubled Christian Europe for centuries. And since the problem, this final solution, was technically solved by Germans, it was the decision of those who organized this panorama that they would tell the history through the lives of two families, one German Nazi, one German and Jewish. And the result is that the program opened up on Berlin and on the Weiss family. And the problem of Mrs. Weiss and her Bechstein piano, caught up in her Mozart, unwilling to believe that politicians mean what they say, that demagogues believe in their demagoguery, that German culture could allow such cruelty as Hitler was spewing forth to in fact be affected. Now, the problem is that German Jews are atypical of those who were to become the victims of the Holocaust. They had warning. They had 7 years of warning between the rise of Hitler and 1939, the emergence of the war, when the doors of Europe snapped tight. There were some 550,000 German Jews in 1932. By 1939, nearly 300,000 of these Jews had emigrated. Escaped. They were to be among the survivors. Now, there were problems. Most countries did not want Jews, and those who accepted some Jews accepted only a few. You had to give up what little you had in order to emigrate. But there was another option, a way out. But east of Germany, there was no period of 7 years of warning. The Polish Jews didn't even have 7 days of warning. 7 days before that fateful 3rd of September, when the Nazi Wehrmacht cracked into Poland, Hitler was saying that we have no argument with the Polish people except over the little port city of Danzig. The Polish Jews had no warning, and of the 3,200,000 or 350,000 Jews in Poland in 1939, less than 360,000 survived the war. Unfortunately, concentrating as this program did on the Weiss family, it began by raising the question, what should they have done, assuming there was something they could do? And obviously in her situation, their situation, one could have closed that Bechstein piano and left it behind and left Germany. The problem of, for me, that the Holocaust faces us with, above all else, is the problem, the life of those anonymous Jews whom we see always in the still photograph, standing in line, waiting to be transported, waiting to be deported from their village, waiting to be taken to the gas chambers. The Jews who had no warning, for whom there never was an option. If a Polish Jew ran away from the ghetto, more likely than not, the partisans in the forest would turn him in to the local Polish authorities, who would turn him in to the Germans. There was no alternative. And how do we deal with impotence, with a life situation from which there is no out, no, for which there is no resolution? What is courage? What is dignity? What should a person do? What can a person do when he's trapped like a rat in a trap, like a rat in the maze? Does courage consist, as we conventionally believe it to be in the West, in fighting back? How do you fight back? What is accomplished by fighting back? When all you can do is to survive the day, perhaps, what kind of strength is required to survive that day? On Wednesday last, I went to my class at the university, and by chance we had come in our overview of the emergence of Jewish thought to the Holocaust, by pure chance. And since I've always believed that you cannot lecture about the Holocaust, that the history itself is not what's at issue here, important though it be, I asked the class to divide themselves into two parts. One part was to be a school board, and another was to be a group of teachers and parents who were coming before the school board with a request that the school introduce at the high school level a course on the Holocaust. And the problem was for this group of teachers and parents who wanted the introduction of this course to explain to the board its justification. What would be learned? What would be the value for the students of this exposure? And the first hand that went up on Wednesday last was that of a young girl who's preparing herself in social work. And she said, it's simple. The reason to teach such a course is to teach the youngsters always to keep their bags packed. It's simple. The reason for such a course is to teach us that we ought not to become so tied down by our possessions, by the culture of which we're part, by the chauvinisms of the society of which we are enmeshed, that we could not move if we had to. And of course, that's a good lesson, a good bit of prudential wisdom. And I suspect that there are Jews in the Union of South Africa who ought to be keeping their bags packed, or ought long since to have packed their bags and left, but who cannot because they are so caught up with their lifestyle, with their possessions, with the culture of which they're more or less a part. But is that really the lesson of, or the basic truth which we must face as we confront the Holocaust? What of those who never had a chance to pack their bags? Isn't that the real question? And the program slid away from that question. It was created by those who, like us, are conditioned to power, to freedom, to options. And the Holocaust says to me, there are times in life when there are no options. What then? What of man? What of God? What of the human soul? What is courage? What is dignity? Many of you may have read in the New York Times last week the preview review by Elie Wiesel of the Holocaust series. a very critical, damning review. Wiesel, of course, is a survivor. He's a man whom I have often identified with because he is exactly my age. And I've often wondered as I read The Gates of the Forest or Night or any of the other evocative works of his, what my life and my spirit and my soul would be like if instead of being born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, I'd been born and raised in Sighet, Romania, where he was born. In 1944, when the Nazis and the Germans and the Romanians finally got around to the Romanian Jews, they began to be deported. Wiesel and his whole family and his whole village were sent to Birkenau. And then he went through a series of other camps, finally to Auschwitz, and he somehow survived, he alone of his family. And after the war, and after some 10 years of silence, as you know, he began to pour out his experiences in fictionalized form, novelized form. And many of us have been able to understand something of the inner life of Jews who suffered under the Nazis by reading these books, relating to them. Wiesel said, in part, "I am appalled by the thought that one day the Holocaust will be measured and judged by the production bearing its name." You know, all week long, I kept this line in mind because one or another kept saying to me, "Rabbi, what did you think of the Holocaust?" Well, the Holocaust is a reality. It is not the program. And unfortunately, I think in many minds, the program will be confused from now on with the reality because it's there. It's an audiovisual technique, you know, available to the schools, to others, to explain what the Holocaust is. As a survivor, Wiesel found that the program consisted of contrived situations, sentimental episodes, and plausible coincidences. And he said, "If they make you cry, you will cry for the wrong reasons." Now, one who is not a survivor cannot judge the accuracy of this criticism. But it's clear that Wiesel is somewhat convinced, despite the evidence of his own work, that no history, no panorama of the Holocaust can be written. He calls the Holocaust the ultimate event, the ultimate mystery, never to be comprehended or transmitted. Only those who were there know what it was. The others will never know. It was easier for Auschwitz inmates to imagine themselves free men than for free persons to imagine themselves in Auschwitz. What then is the answer? How is one to tell a tale that cannot be but must be told? How is one to protect the memory of the victims? How are we to oppose the killers' hopes and their accomplices' endeavors to kill the dead for the second time? What will happen when the last survivor is gone? I don't know. All I know is that the witness did not recognize himself in this film. During the course of his preview, Wiesel used a word which I found suggestive. He called this program a docodrama, a document drama. And you know, one of the interesting facts of our time is that as we have really moved towards mass popular education, a new literary genre has been created, pioneered by men such as James Michener and Leon Uris and Hermann Wolk, a genre which attempts to fictionalize history, to tell history in fiction form, and to do so in a way which they would like to believe gives us a truer presentation of that history than a history book itself might. It's not the old historical romance of the 19th century where simply the romance is the background of whence a pure work of fiction takes place. These men have tried to present to us Ireland and Israel and the American West and a number of other significant moments in more or less recent history in precisely this way: Trinity, Exodus, so on. And obviously, in the last 2 years or so, the television has borrowed this genre and adapted it to its own methods. And we've had Roots, and we've had The King's Story, and now the Holocaust. Now the assumption here is that most people will not take the time or lack the imagination to do the historical research, to read the so-called dry-as-dust history books, and to imagine what it would be like to have lived through a given set of circumstances, a given traumatic moment in time. And these men, in a sense, do it for us. It's a TV dinner kind of literature, all prepared there to our taste. And the problem is, of course, what we get of history is what the author has already understood the history to be, but there's a deeper problem. And that is that the people in these stories are not human beings. They are types. They are stereotypes. They are people who must be at all the critical moments in the history of the Final Solution, or the history of the establishment of Israel, or the history of Hawaii, or the history of the Irish Rebellion, and who must do what was done by a number of people at that moment in time. And so what you get is both too much and too little. You get the vices, and you get the dwarfs going through every significant place associated now with the Final Solution. They're there. They're doing things in Berlin, in Prague, in Warsaw, at Auschwitz, at Babi Yar, that others in fact did. But you get nothing of their inner life, of the spirit. In order to tell history, the characters have to be dehumanized. And what you essentially had during this last week, during this last production, was a tale of the ultimate dehumanization of politics and government and human society, told strangely in such a way as to dehumanize the story that was being told. Rudy Weiss was everywhere. He was in Berlin. He was in Prague. He was in the forests. He was at Sobibor. He was in a Jewish agency, displaced persons camp at the end of the war. And from beginning to end, I found him to be an absolutely empty vessel. In Berlin, the adolescent was simply an adolescent playing soccer, nothing more, disturbed because he couldn't continue in the game because somebody tackled him and called him a dirty Jew. And when he finally left his mother and his sister and his sister-in-law, these three women, and went out to fight, you didn't know whether he felt an urge to kill, whether he was finding his manhood, whether he felt relief, whether he was acting out of desperation. What one or what combination of all of those emotions which roil in any human soul was in fact being expressed? When he fell in love in the middle of the war, and there can't be a television program without young love, was it the need for comfort? Was it a need to perpetuate the race? Was it a need to express himself? Was it a need to find his way beyond the impotence he must have felt? What was involved in this emotion? All you saw were two young people in typical Hollywood fashion, you know, falling in love and acting out the physical sides of love. And when the war was over and he'd had all of this chance to fight back and to join the Russians in the breakout at Sobibor, and you see him in a displaced persons camp meeting his sister-in-law and his nephew, no emotion, no feeling, emptiness. The only thing that seems to move this man who's been through so much is the chance to teach a group of young Greek Jews how to play soccer. Was there no anger? Was no need for vengeance? Was not a cry against God? Was it not some wrestling, love-hate wrestling with this Jewish label he'd borne all his life without having any real meaning associated with? What kind of person was he? You never know. And not knowing the people, not knowing what they went through, is not to know the Holocaust. And what's true of Rudy Weiss is true equally of Dorf. He remained an enigmatic vessel. Was he moved to join Heydrich because of the chance for advancement, because of a nagging wife, because of the uniform that was offered him, because there was no other alternative in Germany? You know, suddenly this young lawyer appears, and as if he had no history. He'd gone through school, there'd been the clubs at the universities he'd been to, these clubs had been anti-Semitic. Hadn't he picked up any of the political tensions of the time? He goes through all of the Eichmann-like
experiences of the final solution. And at the end, he remains an empty vessel whose one function is to take a cyanide pill and to kill himself. Again, is this the image we're to carry around of Germany and German Nazis and of the German people? I wonder. I was not satisfied. The problem, it seems to me, with this program was conceptual. They tried to do too much, and they succeeded in doing too little. They tried to present a history, a diorama, if you will, something visual, a visual history of the final solution to the Jewish problem. And in some ways, they succeeded. All of the moments are there. The Warsaw Ghetto, Auschwitz, the gas chambers, Kristallnacht, and the like. And when I read the book that Gerald Green made out of his screenplay, I thought to myself, you know, this is the kind of book which I might very well assign to my confirmation class next year as a means of sugarcoating a history that they ought to know. We've done that right along. It raises the problems for the first time. Most of us were not dealing with the Holocaust the first time. It's been in the back of our minds or in the front of our minds for the 35, 40 years since the camps were first opened and closed. For a beginning, it was a beginning. For those who had denied the Holocaust or paid no attention to it in the larger non-Jewish world, if they took the time to watch, I suspect it was a meaningful experience for them. They can no longer deny that it happened. Perhaps they understand some of the concerns of we Jews a little better. But I suspect for those of us who have lived under the shadow of the Holocaust, whose whole attitude towards our Jewishness and towards our general philosophic and spiritual stance has had to take this violence, this cruelty, this bestiality into consideration, it was not enough, for there was no sense of humanity to it. It never really came alive. And I've come to the conclusion long since that you cannot tell the story of the Holocaust in a kind of history lesson kind of way. You can't write about it in a single book or present it in even 9.5 hours or whatever it was of television. You know, I know that if I look at a blazing fire too long, I'm going to be blinded. And if I look into the fires of hell, I'm going to be blinded. None of us can comprehend the magnitude, the immensity, the depths of the issues that arise. I find that the only way I can deal with some of the issues as they come forward is to deal with a single incident, a single memory of a survivor, a single bit of Nuremberg testimony, a single diary by a German citizen of the 1930s or 40s. Somehow in that autobiographical sense, when I deal with a single person, a single incident, a single feeling, the honesty of that feeling, I can begin to comprehend some of the issues and some of the problems that the Holocaust raises. What is courage? What does it mean to be caught like a fish in the net? There was a school child at Theresienstadt who wrote as a school assignment, I guess, one day a little four-line poem. And I suspect that someday I can understand the poem, I'll understand something about the lessons of the Holocaust. A little garden. A little boy walks alone. When the blossoms come to bloom, the little boy will be no longer. It so happened that last week here in Cleveland was not only the screening of this television program, but Opera Week. And this strange juxtaposition of events juggled my mind, and I remembered some 20, 25 years ago, another incident told to me by a survivor. I no longer remember the camp that she was in, but I remember the story. She told that in her camp there had been a one-time famous Jewish opera singer. And the woman who was the chief guard of the camp loved music. And several times a week she would order this opera singer to perform in concert for her and for the whatever other of the guards wanted to come. This head guard was obviously knowledgeable. She loved music, she knew music, she responded intensely to the experience. And this other inmate describes how one day after a concert which had moved the head guard a great deal, during which, after which she discussed the music technically and in an informed way with the opera singer. The guard walked out of this little room where the concert took place and walked back towards her office, and along the way she saw a 12-year-old, 13-year-old girl rummaging through garbage cans looking for tomato peelings. The child was starving and needed food. This was illegal according to the camp's laws, and the guard simply picked out her revolver and shot the girl dead and walked back to her office. What is culture? What is the meaning of music? What kind of people were the guards, and were the Nazis, and were the Germans, and were all those in Europe who conspired and aided and abetted in the murder of our people? Another incident. I found this this last week in the newspapers, in the Washington Post. 1938, while exodus was still possible for Jews from Germany and Austria, which had already been overrun, given public indignation in the West at the concentration camps or the rumors of the camps that were spreading, our own government, the French government, the English government, convened in a French spa, Evian, a conference on the refugees. Presumably, the purpose of the conference was to find ways to speed the movement of Jews out of, and other refugees, out of Europe to some kind of safe haven. The first 2 days of the conference were spent with the major delegates wrangling as to who was to be chairman. The afternoon of the third day, 40 representatives of various groups whose people were being threatened by the Nazis were given 3 to 5 minutes to make their presentations. When the afternoon got late, anybody who hadn't yet made his presentation was told to submit his presentation in writing. The conference looked forward to the American delegate's speech, which should be the first speech. America was an empty land, a powerful land, an unthreatened land. Myron Taylor, as some of you may remember, was President Roosevelt's representative at this conference. And Mr. Taylor got up in the Royal Hotel where the conference was taking place, and he said that the United States had looked through its records and that it had recognized that it was taking from 3 to 5 years to process most of the applications for admissions under our quota system, that yes, there were some 27,000 annual quota places available to people in Austria and in Germany, Jews or non-Jews. The American government felt that we could not increase that number, but we had recognized that in all of the preceding 6 years, the quota had never been filled. As a matter of fact, less than 1 year's quota of Jews had gotten into America under this system, and that orders had gone out to our legations in Germany and in Austria to speed up the processing. The back quotas could not be given to this year, but this year's quotas would be processed more promptly. The Canadian delegate was the next to speak. Canada was the second largest nation in the world in land space. It desperately needed people, but the Canadian delegate announced that Canada was looking for people who had wheat farming skills. Unless you were an agriculturalist, the Canadians were not prepared to accept any further immigration. The Brazilian delegate arose, another empty country. A week before the conference, the Brazilian parliament had passed a rule that from then on, all immigration to Brazil would be limited to those who could provide baptismal certificates. And he made that announcement. The Australian delegate arose. At that time, the whole continent of Australia had less citizens than the city of London. And he announced that proudly that Australia had no racial problem and they didn't want to import one. What struck me beyond this history, which I knew, was the concluding interview with an elderly concierge at the Royal Hotel who somehow is still at his old position 40 years later. Oh yes, this man told the writer, I remember the Avignon conference well. Very important people were here. And all the delegates had a very nice time. They took pleasure cruises on the lake. They gambled at night in the casino. They took mineral baths and massages at the Establishment Thermal. Some of them took the excursion to Chamonix to go summer skiing. Some went riding. We have, you know, one of the finest stables in France. Some played golf. We have a beautiful course overlooking the lake. Meetings? Yes, some attended the meetings. But of course, it is difficult to sit indoors hearing speeches when all the pleasures that Evian offers are waiting right outside. Incidents. I suspect these are what we require. Something that's cut down to size that we can deal with. Somebody said to me that the impressions came at them so fast that they were actually grateful for the advertisements and the commercials that they could pull back from the program. But I suspect that the noise was always there and you didn't have a chance to think. And that's what the Holocaust requires. Remembrance, thought, openness, awareness. Final incident. Cleveland. This building 3 days ago. A mother came into the building. She has teenage children. Did you watch the program? No. And you know, Rabbi, I told my children not to. I didn't want them having nightmares. That's finished. Somehow I have a feeling that as long as people shut their eyes, whatever truths the Holocaust may in fact hold have not been learned. And such tragedies of the Holocaust are not finished. Because the Holocaust raises to mind every romantic, naive, and innocent assumption we carry about within ourselves about human nature. Holocaust makes us suspect every suspicion, every carefree, careless moment that we have. This is not the best of all possible world. This is not even a good world. It's a violent world. It can be a vicious place. And if you have been reading, as I have been reading, the newspaper and editorials, the columnist reactions to the Holocaust, you recognize that they haven't heard and they didn't see and they didn't listen. The Holocaust is not a reminder that modern technology is deadly. It's the truth that man is deadly. And the Holocaust is not a reminder that non-Jews suffered as Jews did. It's a reminder of that poison, that racism, which we call anti-Semitism, lit those ovens and is still capable of lighting other ovens today. And the Holocaust is not a measure against which to damn the occasional reprisal by Israelis struggling to survive. And the Nazis are not the only ones who are guilty of the Holocaust. And human nature cannot infinitely take the blows which we are capable of imposing in the process of dehumanization. This was not the best of all possible presentations, if not even a good presentation. But the power, the sheer power of the event carried many along. And we saw not what was presented to us on the screen only, but what we knew deep down as part of the reality. And I think if I were to have any damning criticism to make of the program, would be that its conceptualization was inadequate, but most of all, that its conclusion was trivial. I think if I was angered by any portion of the program, and I confess that, like most of you, I was able to see only parts of it and not the whole, it was that scene in which Dr. Weiss and his printer friend are working on the roads, and the SS comes and announces that particular group of men are to be taken to the delousing chambers, and they know that these are the gas chambers. Now, these men have been through hell for 4 years, five. They've lost their families. They've been reduced to slave labor. They've been brutalized. And somehow, in their souls, there must have been that combination of fear and anger and submission and denial and lethargy and whatever it is that keeps a soul alive. But the scene that we were presented with was a scene of two elderly gentlemen gracefully talking to one another about paid and unpaid doctor bills in Berlin and about a gallbladder which was still acting up despite the doctor's prescriptions. And off they walked. Now, that's not life. And that's not the human soul facing death. And until we can come to some understanding of what it means to be under that kind of sentence of death, and to accept it or to rebel against it after years of hopelessness, until then we will not have begun to empathize, to understand. Perhaps we'll never understand, and Wiesel may be right. But surely we have to make the effort.